From WLVR Bethlehem and Lehigh University, this is the show that gets you behind the real lives of Lehigh faculty. This is Prof Talk.
Hi, welcome to Prof Talks, the only show that gives you insight on your favorite Lehigh professors and the ones you don't like. I'm your host, as always, Austin Katz, and today we have a very special guest. We got Professor Collins, who does research in music computing and psychology. How are you doing today?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Okay, so can you tell our audience a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So I work at the intersection of three fields, music, computing, and psychology. And I work on how we perceive music that we listen to, the structure in that, and then also turn that on its head and say, if we've got this theory of how we perceive music, we should be able to generate music according to that theory and see how that sounds. So that's one part of my work. Another part, looking at how music processing and artificial intelligence can be used to try to kind of create music educational apps that might help draw people into participating in music.
Interesting. So when did you start getting into this field?
My first degree was in music, which I finished back in 2005. So from then on, really, was then interested to look at how the technical aspects of music and science work together. So I took a second degree in maths and statistics, and then a PhD in computing, and then a couple of postdocs, one in the US, one in Austria, and a short job in the UK before coming out to Lehigh.
Have you ever thought of taking a break?
I don't think there's much scope for taking a break in academia, unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start with the first degree, music. Sure. What instruments do you play? What's your favorite genre, et cetera?
Yeah, I play the piano and the guitar. Okay. I don't get much time to practice these days, but those are my instruments. Favorite genre? Well, I grew up listening to rock, indie, so I'd say Stone Roses is my favorite band. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Arctic Monkeys, if you always
said.
Gotta love the Arctic Monkeys.
Yeah, good UK indie scene.
Okay, so then you said you got your degree in computing.
Yeah, I did a second undergraduate degree, which is kind of unusual, but it was possible at the time in the UK. So did 3 years studying music, then 3 years again studying maths and statistics, and then computing as a PhD.
What inspired that change to very different fields?
I was doing a project in the music degree on music and science, and I realized I understood very little about the scientific aspects of it. So having done in the kind of UK equivalent of high school, having done math and physics, then it was a simple kind of decision that, I'd go and study that for a while.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then you decided to combine the two fields and kind of go to this field no one really goes to, music, computing, and psychology.
Yeah, so having done the two separately in the PhD, I managed to combine them for the first time, which, you can do often in computer science departments because they have this kind of interest in applying computational methods beyond, say, core topics that would already be within computing. So you can, draw in these days social media data and analyze it with machine learning algorithms and, music's the same kind of thing. You can extract information from music or people's listening habits and study that within a computer science department.
I mean, it's a lot easier now because data is so widely available, so you can pretty much find anywhere from any source.
Yeah, sure. Sometimes music copyright law stifles research on the music audio itself or even representations derived from it, but yes, what you say is right in general. There's a plethora of data out there, and as you've experienced this semester, it's easy to get hold of, but it's then sometimes time-consuming and a bit painful to knock into the format required for subsequent analyses.
I mean, most research is that, but you have to get it done to get some results.
Yeah, I think with any or with many PhD projects, you speak to the grad student doing it, and there's either a chunk of data collection that's onerous or data processing that's onerous, and it kind of comes with the territory. You have to have the motivation to do that legwork to get beyond that point where you're kind of extending knowledge.
Exactly. Yeah. So what was your first big like research project that you did?
You mean like as a grad student?
Yeah.
I'll try and think back. Looking at automatically extracting patterns from pieces of music. So if you take a song or a piece of classical music, find like the riffs or the themes automatically, so without prior knowledge of that song, and then do that for many pieces of music and compare the output to what a human has annotated for the same pieces and see how different approaches compare to that.
This is fairly recently, I guess, so what did you find?
Well, it's something that I did back in, say, 2008, mm-hmm. and then have kind of revisited on occasion for maybe either mm-hmm. different styles of music, or rather than looking at individual pieces, looking at multiple pieces by the same composer and seeing whether they kind of copied or borrowed material from themselves mm-hmm. in other works. So a fairly recent project in that regard. Looked at Beethoven's piano sonatas. We found some patterns that, you know, were kind of new, you could say, that hadn't been, as far as we could tell, documented in the musicological literature before. So that was quite exciting. We go on to look at then some other composers and other styles of music. So that's, I guess, a research agenda that could last years and years and years, yeah.
I guess. So for audience members who don't know, I did some research with Tom this semester, also on music, computing, and psychology, where we looked at different patterns in music and seeing how different variables affected like the user's listening experience, if they really enjoyed it based on repetitions, pitch, et cetera, et cetera. And so what do you think the results for that was, even though it's a bit early to say?
Yeah, it's in progress. The analysis is in progress among other activities. So the hypothesis behind the experiment was that if we played people passages of music where there were some medium scale repetitions, so you like take, I don't know, 10 seconds, 15 seconds worth of music, and then repeat it and then do something else and play that whole excerpt to somebody, compared with another excerpt that doesn't have any of that repetitive structure, the hypothesis from the psychological literature is that people are sensitive to there being some repetitive structure in the music, and therefore they would rate as more enjoyable or stylistically successful that material that has the repetition. So that's what we'd expect to find. Whether it turns out that way, I'm not sure. We'll see. Previous work has kind of shown it might, but it's kind of inconclusive, and so we've looked at some kind of Johann Sebastian Bach data this semester, and then we'll go on and we'll look at some indie data next semester.
And I do feel like the data would be skewed a little bit, because people have this bias against classical music, or at least the general, I'd say, Lehigh population.
Yeah, I can imagine that students not specifically interested in studying music in this age range would not necessarily seek out classical to listen to, although I know there's a lot of students who play in the orchestra and, mm-hmm. and you know, sing in the choir. The concerts that I've been to, Zollner, kind of speak to that. So yeah, maybe the bias will come through, maybe not. But that's one reason I had in mind for doing the indie related mm-hmm. stuff next semester, because even beyond Lehigh, when you do things, for example, in auto generating music, mm-hmm. and you show that you can quite successfully generate music, new music, in the style of, say, Bach, people aren't as interested in that as if you could generate, you know, like rock or pop or hip-hop hit-type material.
Exactly, yeah. Since the majority of the campus likes, I'd say, EDM or rap or just general pop songs, yeah. top 40 or whatever, do you think that the results would be different if we chose any one of those genre versus indie?
Yeah, it would definitely be worth looking at the enjoyment ratings as a function of people's listening preferences. Mm-hmm. What we try to encourage people to do in the listening experiment is to focus on stylistic success and not just enjoyment. I think we even have them separated out as questions. So you can kind of acknowledge even if you don't like listening to a certain style, that the current excerpt you're listening to is a good version of
exactly
that style. So that way, yeah, there might not be a big bias in the results if you try to point people to those kind of two separate dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mentioned this before. Is there a limit to the certain amount of repetitions in the song? Because you don't want the same two notes to repeat for the whole song.
Yeah, I mean, in general, you might expect to see a Wundt curve, which is a general curve that's seen in psychology experiments beyond music and music processing. So in the general setting, you might be showing somebody some artwork or a TV show or something, you know, some other medium. And on the left before the curve, you've got something that's too simple or repetitive or obvious. On the right-hand side, you've got something that's too complex. People can't wrap their heads around it. Or maybe they could, but they don't want to devote the time to doing so. And then in the middle, at the peak of that curve, you've got the kind of perfect level of complexity for any given listener. So, yeah, for sure.
Okay. This is just a prediction, but how do you think the results are going to compare for a musician who's classically trained, has been doing this her life, versus someone who's only heard a single classical song in their life?
Yeah, we collected some data on people's musical experience, so we can investigate that. And what we might see is that for different types of background, like if we median split it into, say, less experienced and more experienced, we might see that we have a greater level of significance in experienced people with, you know, formal musical training than people with not. But I guess that's to be determined. Yeah, but certainly, going back to the kind of previous discussion we were having about EDM, I mean, that is a genre where it's, you know, really highly repetitive. So people would be tuned into expecting a lot of looping in there, maybe with small amounts of variation from one section to another, whereas if they were listening to some, I don't know, modernist kind of contemporary classical music, it might be a lot less repetitive. Other types of modern classical things are, like, you know, minimalism. It's a little bit like EDM in many ways.
But definitely don't tell that to a hardcore EDM person. Okay. They'd be like, it's different. Deadmau5, it's my life. Every note is unique.
Yeah, well, music's a sensitive topic for a lot of people, right? Because it kind of ties into your identity as a person.
It's who
you
are.
When you start telling people how they perceive music, you can be on rocky ground. And you can certainly be on rocky ground when you use a computer to generate music, because people think of it as something that's almost sacred, that you shouldn't be using computers to generate it. So I do occasionally get angry emails or stuff in the free text part of a web-based experiment where people kind of start trolling me about how I shouldn't be doing this work, which is kind of a bit bizarre. But yeah, it happens sometimes.
People were trolling you in the comments?
Not in the most recent experiment, but okay. I definitely had some fairly angry criticisms about, you know, why it's worth doing this. But as I said at the start, I think it's a way to test whether theories of psychology apply by, you know, taking that theory, generating something according to it, and then seeing how people perceive it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of work out there. I mean, for example, Google have a Magenta project going on at the moment, whose aim is to try to generate compelling music and art. So there's a lot of interest from kind of these big companies in applying machine learning to the humanities, be it art, be it music. So it's quite a nice topic to be working on at the moment.
Okay. Yeah. Right, just to settle an argument.
Yes.
How is indie music and alternative music and rock different?
Oh, I don't know if I should be trying to settle that particular argument. I'd say it maybe in chronological order initially, like rock predates indie, which might, I don't know, maybe nothing predates alternative, but I hear that more used in respect of music from the 2000s or the last
it's years. Age pretty much. I also thought it was due to popularity and generally the lower barrier of entry. So there's so many independent ways to release music now. So it just exploded.
Yeah.
And I feel indie music is generally softer and more relaxed than alternative and rock. Okay. That's just a personal thing.
Yeah, certainly the Arctic Monkeys are a lot more kind of aggressive sounding than the Stone Roses.
Or like The National, for example.
You are listening to Prof Talks, only on WLVR Bethlehem, 91.3 FM.
Anyway, so do you think the idea of repetition, how we really like the things that we've already seen and heard before, that could be placed in other forms of art, like movies, for example. Every Marvel movie, even though I love Marvel movies, they follow the same monolith structure, like the hero gets the power, they learn a lesson, defeat the villain, whatever. And they make billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah.
So do you think that, generally through all forms of art, that we only like or like more the things that we've seen before?
Yeah, there's certainly some evidence in the psychological literature that we tend to prefer things that we're familiar with, even though during the experiments in which that material is presented, people aren't told they've seen these things before. There's definitely an implicit awareness of things to which we've already been exposed, and then you see in people's ratings or other forms of behavior that they preferred things they'd seen previously. But like I was saying earlier about this too simple, too complex, and then the Goldilocks principle of about right in the middle, the same things can all apply to things we seek out to watch. I think that if we see something and we like it, we carry on watching it, but then there's a kind of familiarity breeds contempt type thing. Mm-hmm. And I have that listening to music as well. There's some songs that I was listening to in my formative years, not necessarily from around that time, but things that maybe my parents had shared with me to listen to. So things like songs by Jimi Hendrix or the Beatles, even by the Stone Roses, that I don't seek out and listen to anymore because I think I'm just fed up with them, even though, according to many people, and myself included at one time, they were great songs.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe it takes you back to a state of mind previously that you don't want to look back, you just want to keep on going forward.
Yeah. There's definitely some interesting work on music and nostalgia, and it has hugely powerful nostalgic effects, right, music. Mm-hmm. One of my previous advisors, Peter Giannato, when I was at the University of California, he's done a lot of the important work on music and autobiographical memory.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see via functional magnetic resonance imaging how brain function varies when across different music conditions you're either playing something for which someone has an autobiographical memory or not, and you can see differences in the brain response as a result of that. So music and autobiographical memory or nostalgia, or taking it further, even music and emotion in general, and music and the reward networks in the brain, it's a fascinating topic. It's kind of one topic removed from most of the stuff I've done. But yeah, fascinating stuff.
Wait, but why is music so linked to the brain's psyche? What about it?
Well, there's some ideas, many ideas floating around on that topic. There's one book that in particular, there's a couple of books that are good reads on this topic. One that's specifically about maybe the idea you just mentioned by David Huron, mm-hmm. who is at Ohio State, and it's called Sweet Anticipation, Music and the Psychology of Expectation, mm-hmm. I think is the full title. And one theory is that it's kind of somehow an evolutionary byproduct that we have generally beyond music, the need to analyze incoming information and combine it with previous experience in order to make predictions about the future, because the basis of those predictions either will or won't serve us well as we try to adapt or contend with our environment, so music is one of those streams of auditory information. It's quite complex and it just grabs the brain and you can't avoid that happening. It's kind of hardwired into listening to something and then trying to make predictions for what will come next, whether we're doing that kind of implicitly or explicitly.
plus, try to get a catchy song out of your head, like Call Me Maybe.
Yeah.
After, like, to this day, like, I can, and like, ask anyone on campus, like, just you can say the chorus of Call Me Maybe, and they'll do it.
Yeah. Whether they want to or not is another question.
Right? Oh, my God. Yeah.
You can't get rid of it. Yeah, people do research on, they're called earworms. That's the, mm-hmm. that's the, yeah, the term that people use to refer to them. And that's, yeah, can you predict what will be catchy about something? That's a kind of interesting yeah. question. What will cause something to be more like an earworm than something that's forgettable? So I can't remember the answer off the top of my head, but there's some work on it.
Probably yeah. repetition, if I had to guess.
Yeah, certainly highly repetitive things that, you know, they have a simpler message, but it's repeated in that moment mm-hmm. or in those moments you're exposed to it, so they stand a greater chance of sticking.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Just think about Taylor Swift songs. Like, the chorus itself, it has the same word at least 10 times.
Right.
And she's highly successful. Like, yeah. She knows what she's doing, yeah. so obviously she's doing something right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, so moving on. Can you tell me a little about the work you do with other students, namely Linda and Emily?
Yeah, sure. So we've had three research assistants in the lab this semester, mm-hmm. yourself included. With Linda, we looked at a kind of an application for trying to teach somebody how to read staff notation. So a lot of people have an ability to pick up a guitar and strum a few chords, or even be pretty good at the guitar or the piano, but don't read music. Mm-hmm. And I was at a kind of a hackathon in New York in August, and somebody came along and said they would like to work on an application where music was kind of flashing up for, you know, 5 or 10 seconds, and they had to try to play what was shown. They'd be automatically measured for how well they did that, and then the next piece would show up. So it's a lot like SingStar, it's a lot like Guitar Hero. And you were telling me in the meeting that maybe this version where you show staff notation instead's already been addressed.
It would make sense.
Yeah. But what we can do with a web interface that has this setup is we can record every kind of button press that somebody makes and mm-hmm. record the scores they were getting for each excerpt. And so we can compare this interface where there's a kind of highly interactive experience for mm-hmm. learning staff notation with a more traditional mm-hmm. More traditional kind of written guide for how to learn to read music, and then with a pre-test and a post-test we see how the different conditions affect people's performance across the experiment. And of course, like we discussed in relation to your experiment you ran, we've collected data on their general musical backgrounds and their
exactly.
kind of proficiency going into the test. But if we look at a post-pre-difference, then yeah. to some extent that might, you know, factor out the expertise, which is yeah. which could also be driving some results.
I want to say you're going to use a ANOVA.
Yeah, excellent.
So there we go.
Yeah, three conditions, one way ANOVA.
It's recorded, so I got something yeah. right once.
You can look back at it for revision purposes as well. yeah, the interactive condition is really, it's good fun as well. It's zombies appear when you don't do well enough, and eventually there's a blood kind of zombie apocalypse screen that turns up. So this is important. I mean, it might sound like fun, but if you make a learning experience fun, or you try to build something mm-hmm. interactive into it, then the hypothesis is that it will be more effective than just giving someone a written explanation of how to do it and expect them to do it. So it's about trying to, yeah, kind of draw people in, engage them in something that they find fun or maybe even a bit
exactly,
addictive,
yeah.
and they will improve mm-hmm. themselves. And stepping back from that, oh, I should say first, the name of the interactive
yeah.
Interface is Dawn of the Dyad. So it's like a pun on Dawn of the Dead, where you've got dyad is like two music notes together.
God.
So it's a pretty good pun, and that's going to help.
Is it as good as Arctic Artificial Monkeys?
Right, pun on artificial intelligence. I'd say it's maybe better.
Ooh,
yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Guess I'll have to think of another one then.
Yeah. Stepping back from
AI indie music.
AI. Yeah, no, it's not as catchy as Dawn of the Dyad.
We'll see.
Yeah,
okay,
we'll
have all break.
Yeah, stepping back from those two experiments, the the kind of one of the general purposes of my work is to try to develop interfaces, applications that broaden participation mm-hmm. in music. So it's been shown in several different ways that if you as a young person engage in some kind of musical activity, it can lead to benefits in other areas of your education, so numeracy, literacy, and the other ingredient of that is that music education, you know, one-on-one tuition, it tends to be expensive, mm-hmm. so you kind of have then an education system that's, in terms of other skills like numeracy or literacy, it's biased towards people who can afford such things. So that's a kind of social aspect to my work, which has only really kind of become, you know, I've become aware of over the last few years, but it's definitely something I want to achieve mm-hmm. in the next 5 to 10.
Very important. Subconsciously, did you use zombies because of the Thriller video?
It might have been playing into the decision. I think it was at the hackathon. It was the guy who I worked with, he's called Brian Pajian, and it was his idea that there should be some zombies involved.
Exactly, yeah.
At some stage. I was more thinking, how do we get these music excerpts to appear in the web interface? So only very recently have really nice HTML5 technologies come online that enable you to do this kind of thing. So I was more focused on the technical aspects than the zombies. And then Emily's project's also quite cool. It's called Drum Loop. It doesn't have a pun involved.
Like, what's the point of doing research
if there are no puns?
Exactly. Yeah.
So we have to rethink the title. But basically you have an interface where you click in a grid, and the different grid lines are associated with different drum sounds, and the different columns are representations of time. So you, by clicking in this grid or matrix, you basically make a drum loop. Mm-hmm. And there's a special button in one of the conditions where you can click it, and it uses the same type of algorithm that's behind the experiment you've worked on, mm-hmm. where it will just take what you did, look up across a bunch of EDM tracks for similar events and what came next, and give you a suggestion for how to continue your own track based on combining previous music. So it's quite an innovative way to try to, for example, break writer's block or to mm-hmm. write a drum track quickly if you're rushed. So a lot of composers will kind of write for commissions, and they really want to be doing that work, but they also say have to write commercials, mm-hmm. music for commercials, or other kind of stuff that brings in the money. So, you know, to have something that does that quickly, it could be of interest to them, or just
definitely.
For people making music in general. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's essentially like a dashboard thing. The remember the thing I sent you where it was press a button and that music would play?
Yeah, you were dragging different chunks of music into a mix, right? And you could, a web interface for doing that. So you could click on something and turn it off, click on something else and
exactly.
turn it back
it's
on.
Yeah, exactly. It's essentially like that.
Yeah. It's like that. It's somehow maybe a bit more of an atomic level, because you've got control over the individual drum sounds and when mm-hmm. they occur. Whereas within that thing, it was like pre-composed samples that you were combining and taking in or out, right?
Yeah, that was a promotional material, so I'll cut it some slack. But it was so cool, though,
yeah.
And everything was, I'd say, the same BPM, so it flows into each other well.
Yeah.
So do you think that if you release this to the public, they would need some sort of previous knowledge of, like, general beats and music before using, or they can just go on in and be, I'll make a drum loop, beep, boop, boop, done.
I think it's about knowing your users and their demographics. So the thing that you sent me was obviously really effective, because you could come to it and within 5 or 10 seconds have clicked on or dragged 5 to 10 things and made mm-hmm. something that sounded really cool.
Yeah.
Whereas with Emily's drum loop interface, there's a little bit more work involved, mm-hmm. and I'd say there's yet more another degree of work involved in terms of writing beyond the drum track, so adding in bass or other melodic parts, vocals, you know, actually then writing your own song. So I think it's about tracing a path that you can have these very intuitive, relatively simple interfaces, mm-hmm. and then something that's a little bit more complex. But if someone's interested in doing the first thing, they might try something that's a bit harder, and then again. So
it's a jumping off point, pretty much.
Yeah. You have some prototypes that get people interested, and then they're willing to invest a bit more time.
You are listening to Prof Talks, only on WLVR Bethlehem, 91.3 FM.
Okay, that's interesting. So, did you do a test on how many combinations there are?
For the drums?
Yeah, potential combinations.
So, with Emily's project, the idea was to basically have them compose in one condition where they don't have this magic suggestion button,
mm-hmm.
and then in a second condition to write a second loop without the button. Did I say without both times?
I'll just start that bit again. So the magic of editing, it's great. Yeah.
So the idea with Emily's project is to have one condition where they have the button for the magic suggestions that continue their drum track, and in the other condition they don't have that button, and then we will take those tracks they write. We won't tell other people who write them which condition they came from, and we'll see if there's any difference in the perceived musical creativity of the material that people are writing. That's about the impact of artificial intelligence on students' work, but it could be on other aspects of, like, it could just be composers' work in general or kids' music education in other circumstances. So you had a question about number of combinations.
Yeah.
You mean how many drum tracks could you potentially...
Potentially, yeah.
Well, it's finite but very large is the quick answer. So without going into the math too much, you could have any combination of drums on any discrete time unit.
Mm-hmm.
And in Emily's interface, there are, I think, four... The beat is subdivided into four. You've got four beats in a bar, and there are four bars or measures in US terminology. So you've got kind of 64 time points, and then a very large number of potential combinations of drums on any of those time points. So it's a huge, if you were to generate all possible drum tracks, which you could do theoretically, you'd then, it'd be like, finding the good ones would be like finding a needle in a haystack. And that's kind of, so you're trying to define a search space that's a bit more tractable. That's kind of how music generation or music and machine learning would work in general. Acknowledge that the total possible number of compositions or songs you could come out with is huge. So you have to try to find interesting ways to search that space, such that what you find is interesting.
Okay, for participants in Emily's experiment.
Yeah.
I totally forgot the word there for a second. Was it possible to record what they made?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So we've got click-by-click data of the drums that they specified at each time point. Mm-hmm. And so we can not only see the final product, but we can see, like, a time-lapse image of how it was constructed. Like, also, so not just when they added or took away notes themselves, but... when they asked for suggestions, what those were, if they undid them, or if they continued to work with them.
Do you think that, is there some way to export that file into an MP3 and allow, if the participant wanted, to keep that file that they made as kind of a memento and inspire them to, like, continue looking into this field of music?
Yeah, I ran a similar experiment previous to this semester, but instead of them generating the drum track,
mm-hmm.
they were given a drum track and they had to do a synth part, and we ran that with kind of music producers, and for that we sent them the MIDI file after,
mm-hmm.
which they would be then comfortable kind of importing into their music processing application of choice and working with it. So yeah, certainly it's possible to do that. We didn't do it this time, but it's possible.
How important is, when making an experiment, a user interface? Because that pretty much makes or breaks the enjoyment of an experiment.
Yeah, well, in general, I think psychologists aren't necessarily focused on interface design, but because of my combination of interests in music and computing, I tend to run experiments where there are relatively quite rich interfaces. In other experiments, you might, for example, do something on the effect of the color of words on memory, and you just see words in different colors,
it's
right?
Whatever.
So in that circumstance, the study is focused on perhaps more fundamental research, and the interface is not of particular concern. In fact, the general underlying construct you're investigating should come out in any number of experiments, regardless of the exact interface setup. I think when you start having slightly richer interfaces in experiments, like the ones we've run this semester, it probably matters a bit more how you tweak certain things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if, like, let's say the drum loop or the zombie ones wasn't fun, like, people wouldn't do it.
Right.
That's just the problem with most educational days, because it's just, like, it's supposed to teach something, but if it's not fun, why play it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a payoff, a trade-off, I should say, between how fun you try to make something as part of somebody's education and how hard it is. But I think they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, because getting information into your head where you can A, memorize it, and B, maybe eventually understand it and apply it, that's hard work, and it should hurt your brain to do it.
100%, yeah.
So it can't all just be about trying to make something fun. If it doesn't do what it's meant to do, then that's not a good way to have
exactly.
pursued
mm-hmm.
that aim of helping somebody to understand or learn something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that will be one of the things we look at for Linda's experiment in particular, this kind of high interactivity mode, a minimal feedback/interactivity mode, and then a kind of standard written guide that people read. So we'll see how much the fun mattered in that case.
Do you think with Linda's experiment that it can transfer to other instruments like guitar or like drums?
The Dawn of the Dead one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it depends on how easy it is to hook something up to the computer. So in her experiment, we just used the traditional like typewriter layout of the keyboard, but we mapped it to the piano keyboard's notes so that people could just sit at the laptop and press keys, and it would make a kind of synthesizer noise. If you were going to do this for guitars, you'd want somebody to be holding the guitar, right? Mm-hmm. But to be recording the data they were providing on the computer. So you'd need a MIDI-enabled guitar, basically, which would be expensive but doable, and then you'd have to make sure the instrument and the interface were able to talk to each other.
I've been very selfish. Like, what do you want to talk about?
I want to know whether you're drawing any inspiration from Between Two Ferns for this.
Oh my god.
This feels like a similar setup. I mean, minus the ferns.
Oh, like,
that just goes, that's, I suppose, more to do with your budget.
Oh my god. I wish I was like Between Two Ferns. Like, Zach Galifianakis is so funny.
It's funny.
And like, I'm not nearly as funny as him and his team of writers. And plus, like, I kind of work with every professor I interview on a daily basis. So if I destroy that relationship, it won't be good at all.
Yeah, that's the difficulty, right?
Oh my god, yeah. Do you watch the Eric Andre show?
No.
Oh, so it's like that, but like 100 times worse. And he cranks up the heat so his guests are hot and uncomfortable. Like, one show he put a dead fish in the vent so it just smelled the whole time. And he's just the most ridiculous. I can't explain this.
Okay.
You'll have to see it for yourself. Okay. And so, like, I've been compared to that with at least the shirt incident.
Yeah.
With Fred and Simon. Oh, okay. All right, so seriously, is there any significant results that you found in your research that really impacted you?
I think the most exciting results recently were the kind of the output of the music generation model on the Bach style music.
Mm-hmm.
So we had 25 people listen to excerpts of that. They had a couple of tasks, one of which was to say for any given excerpt, was it computer generated or was it real Bach?
Mm-hmm.
And a second task was to rate the stylistic success of each excerpt. So out of those 25 people, only 5 did significantly better than chance at telling if it was human or computer generated. So that was pretty exciting because we're not there yet, but we're getting closer towards saying for specific styles, we can generate material using a computer to chop up existing and music and recombine it. We can basically generate material as good as a, you know, one of the musical greats can write it, which is pretty exciting, I think. There are many caveats to that, you know, to do with, well, it works for a certain type of composition by Bach, but not necessarily for others, because I haven't had time to investigate that. It works less well for Chopin. So, yeah, there's lots to do still, but it's quite exciting results.
So, essentially, it's like a Turing test.
Yeah, the difference would be that in Alan Turing's proposition for that test, should we do it again when there's no background noise?
Sure, why not? It's fine. It's okay. Whatever, yeah.
Is it, you want to ask if it's like a Turing
test? Yeah, is it essentially like a Turing test?
It's similar. The Turing test is based on the idea that there will be an interaction between two entities, one of which is sold to the human participant as possibly a computer, possibly a human, and they have to tell the difference based on an interaction. Whereas the experiment I ran with the Bach music and the Chopin music, it was there was no interaction there. You were just listening to a already composed excerpt. With the drum loop experiment, though, on the other hand, you could make that like a Turing test, where some of the times you were getting suggestions from someone, you know, actually listening to what the participant was doing and writing something quickly for them and sending that back, or it could be coming from the algorithm. So that's probably where the research goes. It goes several ways, but people generally aren't interested in being able to press a button and get out a finished, really great piece of music. They want to have some involvement in that process. That's where I think also people get a bit frustrated with this. It's like, what's the point of automatically generating something from beginning to end? I would like to be able to work with this technology to kind of enhance my own creativity. So, yeah.
Be honest here. Be honest. How concerned are you for a robot music revolution? Taking over the music industry, no survivors, all robots.
I'm not sure if I'd be concerned or excited by that prospect. I saw some exciting things happening in the music industry when it looked like the kind of the stranglehold of big old-fashioned record companies was being undermined by you know, file sharing initiatives, or people trying to get more independent music out there. And then, as far as I can see, that stranglehold has been re-established by, you know, the big companies these days, like Spotify or Google Music and Apple. So if I was to be excited by any revolution in the music industry, I think it would be by, you know, an increasing number of people being able to create and produce and then disseminate or distribute their music within you know, within a home studio, or just using a like, you know, the facilities available on a laptop without specialist recording equipment. I think you'd lose a lot maybe in quality, but there'd probably still be some great music that found audiences that way, which in the current setup wouldn't happen.
In theory, in the future, could we see something like a little indie known artist who writes a song has to compete against a guy who wrote a computer algorithm which inputted different music and he created a song? Like, do you think like they'll clash, like this computer generated song versus this from the heart one?
Maybe, but maybe the from the heart one would win every time, because
in theory at least.
Yeah. Going back to the music and robots thing, there are already some interesting musical robots out there. I don't know if you've seen them.
Like, there's, what?
So there's a researcher called Gil Weinberg who works at Georgia Tech,
mm-hmm.
and he has some robots that kind of have the ability to listen to and entrain to the beat of music that's playing in mm-hmm. the room, and then they start moving their limbs in time.
Oh my God,
with it.
That's awesome.
So you should check that out. I think it was already in a... I'm not sure if it's his robots I saw in the commercial, but it was a car commercial that featured robots around last holiday season that looked mm-hmm. quite similar to the robots I'd seen from his. So yeah, there's already beat tracking algorithms out there. So that means, you know, you play a song to the computer and you ask it, where are the main beats here?
Mm-hmm.
And we can do that with varying degrees of success, but you can then, you know, it's quite an easy step to then start moving robotic limbs in time with anticipating where the next beats will be. So the revolution is here. In terms of your question about from the heart versus computer generated, I'm not sure what my answer would be. What's the question again?
Do you think there'll ever be a time where people have to compete against each other? Data scientists who fed in data from all sorts of music created this song versus a artist who's trained his whole life and wrote a song?
That's a good question. I think it's going to be more the case that the technology that's available gets integrated into the artistic process. So I think that artists who are interested in working with automatically generated suggestions might have an edge over artists who don't. That might be the case, but I think it's generally not a very exciting prospect to fully automate any creative process, because then there's no human in the loop, and having humans in the loop might be what, you know, sells records or gets people involved.
In theory, I guess.
Yeah.
You are listening to Prof Talks only on WLVR Bethlehem, 91.3 FM.
Okay, again, another very serious question.
Yes.
How far do you think it will be until we get a real-life Marvin the Robot from Hitchhikers?
I'm waiting. I remember people complaining about, or saying we'd have hoverboards, and people complaining that we don't have those either, but that's the way technology happens, right? It's unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because, like, you have all these happy robots, like, no one thought of making a sad one? Like, come on. And it's so funny, too. It's like, is there anything cool, interesting, new whatsoever?
No. I've had a very sleep-deprived 2 months, 3 months, because I had 2 new teaching preps this semester, mm-hmm. plus, you know, as we've discussed, trying to get all the experiments around.
True.
It's been there's not been a great opportunity for just, you know, aimless web searching or days where you just discover new things. It's been a fairly intense few months, but in the summer I did go and see the Stone Roses in New York. It was cool to be, because I didn't see them growing up.
Mm-hmm.
They were, I suppose, successful in the really late 80s and early 90s when mm-hmm. I was too young to go to.
No, they're still touring, gigs, like, good for them.
Yeah, well, I think they had a break, and then they've done, like many bands do these days, mm-hmm. they did a kind of a revival tour. Played some dates in the UK and one in New York.
We were on a break,
right.
Friends.
Noted. In fact, quite often I feel like the... you've seen the episode in Friends where Ross is going to take Rachel to the prom, and he's sitting on the steps playing his little synthesizer.
Yeah, yeah.
Sitting on the stairs. Generally, when I run like a music experiment, or I'm playing a little demo on the keyboard and it's making synth noises, I think back to that scene quite a lot. The kind of pathetic Ross sitting on the stairs doing his music.
Well, he did eventually get Rachel, so like...
Yeah, so every cloud has a silver lining.
But like, if you get Jennifer Aniston, that's a huge win. Huge. Like, oh my God. I did see something interesting. Yes. They have these little pocket synthesizers that create essentially the same drum loop type of thing. And they fit in your pocket, and they're like $60. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, great. I mean, you'd think that... I mean, I've seen stuff on the smartphone, you know, size,
mm-hmm.
scale, that's pretty successful for creating loops. But this one is actually a piece of hardware.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. If I wanted to create something like that, what would I do?
To build the hardware itself? Yeah, that's a good question. I am not an expert in the hardware side of things. Mm-hmm. Just more the kind of software that would go, underneath the hood. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people who do things with music hardware, and you know, these kind of hackathons that I go to, there tends to be more of an emphasis on software, but there are people soldering things together and making stuff in the moment.
So then here's my next question. If I wanted to get into kind of software in this field and coding, whatever, what would I do and what would your advice be?
Go to the music hackathon in New York City and see what else is going on. Mm-hmm. I think when I started my PhD, I didn't have much of an idea of what else was going on in the field and who the key people were. So just some general web searching on music computing, music psychology, see what papers you find, see where people are at. Generally, academics are very responsive to emails. If their teaching load isn't too large, they will, reply to you if you have a question about where you could look for things. Join email lists. Mm-hmm. There's a good one that I'm on, which is for the International Society of Music Information Retrieval. So, kind of Google group/email list, and you very quickly tap into the experts in any given field that way, and they don't mind kind of newbie questions.
Okay. I think that's a good note to end on. Is there any place they can reach you at or kind of stay updated with your research?
Oh yeah, the research homepage is tomcollinsresearch.net.
Okay, cool. And do you have a Twitter page that they can follow or whatnot?
I started a kind of a music apps company a couple of years ago, so we have a Twitter page. We'll try and remember what
but
it is.
You never told me that.
Yeah, we. I mean, it's kind of on the back burner at the moment, mainly due to the number of teaching preps at Lehigh. But I think that's Music AI Alg. That's the Twitter handle for that. Yeah. Okay. I think any combination of AI algorithm, Music AI was already taken. So okay. It's pretty. Yeah, tricky to get good handles these days.
All right, cool. Thank you for your time. Right, I appreciate it.
Okay.
You just listened to Prof Talks only on WLVR Bethlehem 91.3 FM. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Prof Talk. To hear all the interviews and check out extended material, log on to our archives at WLVR.org.